Good morning and welcome to the Library Show. My name is Brooke and I am your host this week, and I am also a librarian, at least some of the time. And I am joined today by a fellow librarian from the public library, Tracy Turner. Thank you for coming in this morning to talk with me about books.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And I think we should just jump right in. I think you've got a nice little stack of books lined up. And so let's hear it. Let's find out what's in your book bag. What have you got for us today?
Well, today I brought some of my favorite historical mysteries. These are not necessarily classic literature or heavy, thought-provoking in the most traditional educational sense, but they're great reads and a lot of fun. And what I like about the historical aspect of them is that they often have insight into a particular time period that you don't necessarily get from your history books.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit of entertainment while you're learning about history a little bit.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like popcorn during the professor's lecture or something like that.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. This has been like a book to just enjoy too. You know,
exactly.
A well-written book. It doesn't have to really be teaching you something new every time, but just something that you thoroughly enjoy. So what's the first book that you have?
Well, so I brought examples from several different series And some of them are pretty popular and folks may have heard of. The first one, I think, is by Lori King. And it's one of a series with the heroine is named Mary Russell. And the idea behind this series is that Sherlock Holmes, in his later years, actually married. And Mary Russell started out as his partner in crime solving and then became his partner in life.
Oh, cool. I had no idea that these were Sherlock Holmes kind of spin-off.
Yeah, exactly.
Books.
So, and they're all written from the perspective of a woman. And some of the books, particularly some of the earlier ones, really pulled in a lot of the life of a woman in that day and age as opposed to the life of a man. And this particular woman, this heroine, who is quite modern for her time and often will dress as a man so that she can do things and go places where she wouldn't otherwise be allowed to. One of the titles, one of the early titles, is such a great title. It's called A Monstrous Regiment of Women. I love it. But this one is a actually later book. Then it's called The God Hive. A lot of the book's titles have something that refer to bees because, according to Holmesian legend, he was a renowned beekeeper.
So, and sorry, forgive me that I don't know even Holmes that well, but she was a character from the original Sherlock Holmes?
Not at all.
No, okay.
No,
this
not at all. In fact, in the first Lori King book, she was just a schoolgirl who lived or moved to a house down the street from where Holmes had retired.
Okay, and so they meet in Lori King's books.
Yes.
She's the creator of this new...
She is, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
So I'm just going to read just a little bit of the first chapter of this book, The God Hive. Chapter 1. A child is a burden after a mile. After 2 miles in the cold sea air, stumbling through the night up the side of a hill and down again, becoming all too aware of previously unnoticed burns and bruises, and having already put on 8 miles that night, half of it carrying a man on a stretcher, even a small, drowsy 3.5-year-old becomes a strain. At 3 miles, aching all over, wincing at the crunch of gravel underfoot, spine tingling with a certain knowledge of a madman's stealthy pursuit, a loud snort broke the silence, so close I could feel it. My nerves screamed as I struggled to draw the revolver without dropping the child.
So is that from the perspective of this Mary Russell?
Okay. Yes, and all of the books are told from her perspective, which
okay.
is really quite a different look at the whole Sherlock Holmes ideology, and they're just wonderful reads, quite fun.
What a funny way to open up a story, too.
Right, like, a child is a burden.
Right.
But she never wanted children, and, you know, mm-hmm. Holmes never particularly seemed to like children, except for his the boys, the Baker Street gang, who the ragamuffins, the street urchins who were spies for him.
Mm-hmm. So does he show up then in her?
Oh, yes, in all
he's
of them.
Throughout
yes,
all of them. And they're working together kind
yes,
of.
Yes, they're working together.
Okay. Oh, it sounds really fun.
They're quite a good time. And, you know, they're serious. They're not meant to be a farce at all, but they don't take themselves overly seriously.
Okay. Right.
The next set that I wanted to talk about is by the author Jacqueline Winspear, and this is also British, and her heroine is called Maisie Dobbs.
Very popular.
Very popular.
Is, yeah.
And this one is also not the first in the series. Maisie Dobbs was a young woman who started out as a maid in a very wealthy household. And she would sneak down into their library to read at night, and she was totally self-educated. And she got caught when she was about 12, which would have been a firing offense. Mm. And instead, the family took her in and ended up educating her. And she eventually opened her own private investigating office.
Now, is this kind of a class thing, or is this also a race thing? Is this
mostly class?
Okay, yeah, so she was just a kind of a lower class,
yes,
working for this wealthy family.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Her mom had passed away. Her dad was a fishmonger, and she was put into service to support herself.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And instead, she, you know, rises up and becomes
a detective.
Yeah, and that's partly because she's very bright, and she has they have a close family friend who is a detective, but he uses psychology and some meditation and Zen techniques too in his detecting, and he sees promise in her and he begins to train her.
Oh, this sounds fascinating. So she, excuse me, is potentially learning, and the reader is too, about some Zen theory.
Yeah. Definitely the quieting of the mind, the clearing of the thought. She uses abstract drawings, making connections of things when she's trying to solve a case.
Okay.
Wow. So the beginning of this one, this is actually the third novel. It's called Pardonable Lies. Chapter 1. The young policewoman stood in the corner of the room, plain whitewashed walls, a heavy door, a wooden table with two chairs, and one small window with frosted glass rendered the room soulless. It was a cold afternoon, and she'd been in the corner since coming on duty 2 hours ago, her only companion, the rumpled and bent girl sitting in the chair that faced the wall. Others had come into the room to sit in the second chair. First, Detective Inspector Richard Stratton, with Detective Sergeant Caldwell standing behind him. Then Stratton standing while a doctor from the Maudsley Hospital sat before the girl, trying to get her to speak. The girl, no one knew her age or where she had come from, because she hadn't spoken a word since she had been brought in this morning, her blood-stained dress, hands and face showing a month's worth of dirt, was now waiting for another person who had been summoned to question her, a Miss Maisie Dobbs. The policewoman had heard of Maisie Dobbs, but with what she had seen today, she wasn't sure that anyone could get this young scrubber to talk. The policewoman heard voices outside the door, Stratton and Caldwell, and then another voice, a smooth voice, a voice that was neither soft nor loud, that did not need to be raised to be heard, or, thought the policewoman, to get someone to listen.
I like this opening how, I mean, as a reader, I guess it's the third book, and so you're familiar, I'm sure most people who are reading this book know Maisie Dobbs, but the introduction of her, clearly, there's some build-up to who is this kind of mysterious Maisie Dobbs. She's going to work some magic on this girl that's being detained. So I don't know, there's this nice build-up in the beginning there.
Sure, and the last book, too, both of these series, while there is an overlying story arc, you don't necessarily have to read them in order. You can read them as standalone books, which is a great thing.
Right. So I guess each time you do, kind of, the writers do need to introduce the characters.
Sure. Yeah. But you don't want to be heavy-handed about it. You want to, you know, you don't want your longtime readers to be bored with that introduction. So yeah,
thanks.
I think that Jacqueline Winspear does this in a really clever way. And these stories are all, these are after the Great War, which would have been the First World War. Mm-hmm. So this is between the First and Second World War. And again, they're British.
Do you have any American? Or have you chosen actually?
I do. Let's see if I can pull that up.
It's kind of fun hearing the introductions of these pieces so far, these novels so far, to get a taste of how the writer is trying to lure us in, you know, and what they do to catch our attention.
So this series is set at the turn of the century, and they're set in Seattle. The main character is a professor of electrical engineering at University of Washington named Professor Bradshaw. And the book is by the series of books are by Bernadette Pager, I believe it's pronounced, P-A-J-E-R. So okay. I'm not sure about that. And gosh, I love reading these because they often will pull up places and describe them. And because people in Alaska are often very familiar with Seattle, it's just like seeing bits of home in the book. It's really fun. So these are the early days of electricity, and yet this guy is an electrical engineer. And the first book is called A Spark of Death, I believe. Chapter 1. A curtain of pale hair hid the young man's downturned face. His skinny fingers trembled as he toyed with the pencil. He'd been staring at his examination paper without making a single mark for 10 minutes. Test anxiety. Professor Benjamin Bradshaw knew it well. Bradshaw himself had never been good at written examinations. It was the blank page, the abstract theory, that vexed him. Put him on a pole with a length of wire to string, give him the components of an electrical motor to assemble, and his mind sang. This young man was much the same. Professor Bradshaw spoke softly. Mr. Dalton. Oscar Dalton froze, gripping the pencil so tightly it snapped in two. Bradshaw slid open his desk drawer and found a sharp lead pencil. As he stood, the squeal of his chair legs scraping the hard floor pierced the hollow silence. He crossed the empty classroom, the other students had long gone, and set the new pencil on the edge of Dalton's desk. The young man did not look up. He'd spread his hands protectively over his test, but Bradshaw could see some work had been done. Take your time, Bradshaw put a reassuring hand on the young man's shoulder. I'm in no hurry. He retreated to the window, his chest tight with the ghosts of his own youth. In his college years, he'd believed that he would one day leave anxiety behind. Maturity and experience would sweep worry away. How wrong could he be? With age came new forms of anxiety. Apparently, 35 was the age of discovering oneself to be a plodding old fool, and the kinetoscope, the modern-day mirror, reflecting what he'd been blissfully missing. Bradshaw squared his shoulders. Kinetoscopes be damned.
So this one is not only set in the United States, which is different than the other two you read from, but also he's not a detective. He's a professor.
He's a professor, but they, yes, he happens to stumble on a mystery, a murder,
okay,
at the school, a death anyway, and he discovers that he has a mind for solving mysteries. So he continues to be a professor,
mm-hmm,
but kind of like the way, you know, you'd never want to be invited to a dinner party with the woman from Murder, She Wrote, because somebody always dies, or an Agatha Christie story. He's kind of like that. It seems to be he stumbles upon death regularly.
I guess it wouldn't be a mystery if there wasn't someone,
that's right,
you know, having trouble in there. So,
that one, I said, was, you know, turn of the century. And, yes, the United States. There's another one I think I can get to that is actually set in Canada from a little bit earlier time. The author is Maureen Jennings, and she is pretty well, her books are pretty well known because they have been made into, they've been made into a TV series for PBS called Murdoch Mysteries.
Okay.
But these are really not much like the,
TV series
at all. The TV series is very tongue-in-cheek. You know, he's brilliant. The main character is brilliant, and he's very inventive, and he invents all these different things way before the real inventor invents them. And in almost every episode, he meets someone famous from the past, you know, Thomas Edison or Arthur Conan Doyle, or, okay, you know, who knows?
Right.
Anyway, but in the books, they're a lot more serious and a lot darker, I guess, is the way to put it. I'm just going to read a little bit from the prologue of this. It's the first book as called Poor Tom is Cold. Actually, this is the third book in the series, and this is the prologue. Since the boy had died, she didn't sleep. and many nights she prowled around the house searching. She is quiet so as not to wake any of the others, but they knew and talked about it when she wasn't there. This night was particularly bad. It was long past midnight, and she'd heard the grandfather clock in the hall chime. She counted out the number of gongs, not wanting the sound to die away, as it was comforting, like a voice. After a while, the snuffles and groans of her sleeping husband were insufferable, and she got out of bed. She didn't put on her dressing gown or slippers, even though the room was chill. She went out to the landing. A slit of light was showing beneath the door opposite, and she knew he was not in bed. She walked over and went in without knocking. He was seated at his writing desk and turned quickly when he heard her enter. She was glad she had startled him. She smiled a false smile, hiding her fear. He regarded her coldly. He didn't get up, didn't exclaim in concern or wonderment. He merely sat and waited for her to say something.
Wow, that's a much darker opening than the other ones you've read.
Yeah, these stories are quite dark and so very different from the TV show, but well worth the read, I think, even of fans of the show. I think they'd really like them. So that's Maureen Jennings. Do we have time for more?
We do, yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Let's go on to
I want to go on to one of my very favorite characters ever, I think. This author is Alan Bradley. This is another pretty popular series. And I'm just going to read a little bit of the back of this book, the back cover, and then I'll if we have time, I'll read the beginning of the book.
Great.
This character, Flavia DeLuce, is an 11-year-old girl, and she, I think I identify with her more than I have ever identified with any character. In fact, I think she's so well written that I was really surprised to discover that the author was a man, because he really pegged, to me anyway, an 11-year-old girl. They're not sweet. Just to clarify.
Is that why you relate to her?
Probably, yes. You'll see. Okay, so the synopsis on the back. It is the summer of 1950, and at the once grand mansion of Buckshaw, young Flavia DeLuce, an aspiring chemist with a passion for poison, is intrigued by a series of inexplicable events. A dead bird is found on the doorstep, a postage stamp bizarrely pinned to its beak. Then, hours later, Flavia finds a man lying in the cucumber patch and watches him as he takes his dying breath. For Flavia, who is both appalled and delighted, life begins in earnest when murder comes to Buckshaw. I wish I could say I was afraid, but I wasn't. Quite the contrary. This was by far the most interesting thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life.
How did she get that name? That's what I want to know. And where is Buckshaw? Where does this take place?
This is in England in 1950. Oh, okay. Yes, Flavia DeLuce. And her home is a run-down manor home. The family money and the home came from her mother, and her mother's been missing since shortly after she was born.
Okay, so a mystery right from the get-go.
Right from the get-go. And that is the overlying story arc of this series. But each story stands on its own. Do we have time for just a little bit of this?
We definitely do. Let's hear it.
Okay. Yeah. I love this book, and this is, to me, I don't know, maybe because I grew up with big brothers and Flavia grew up with big sisters, but this just sounds like childhood to me. Chapter 1. It was as black in the closet as old blood. They'd shoved me in and locked the door. I breathed heavily through my nose, fighting desperately to remain calm. I tried counting to 10 on every intake of breath and to 8 as I released each one slowly into the darkness. Luckily for me, they had pulled the gag so tightly into my mouth that my nostrils were left unobstructed, and I was able to draw in one slow lungful after another of the stale, musty air. I tried hooking my fingernails under the silk scarf that bound my hands behind me, but since I always bit them to the quick, there was nothing to catch. Jolly good luck, then, that I'd remembered to put my fingertips together, using them as 10 firm little bases to press my palms apart as they had pulled the knots tight. Now I rotated my wrists, squeezing them together until I felt a bit of slack, using my thumbs to work the silk down until the knots were between my palms, then between my fingers. If they had been bright enough to think of tying my thumbs together, I should never have escaped. What utter morons they were. With my hands free at last, I made short work of the gag. Now for the door. But first, to be sure they were not lying in wait for me, I squatted and peered out through the keyhole at the attic. Thank heavens they had not taken the key away with them. There was no one in sight, save for its perpetual tangle of shadows, junk, and sad bric-a-brac. The long attic was empty. The coast was clear. Reaching above my head at the back of the closet, I unscrewed one of the wire coat hooks from its mounting board. By sticking its curved wing into the keyhole and levering the other end, I was able to form an L-shaped hook, which I poked into the depths of the ancient lock. A bit of judicious fishing and fiddling yielded a gratifying click. It was almost too easy. The door swung open, and I was free. I skipped down the broad stone staircase into the hall, pausing at the door of the dining room just long enough to toss my pigtails back over my shoulders into their regulation position. Father still insisted on dinner being served at the clock as the clock struck the hour and eaten at the massive oak refectory table, just as it had been done when Mother was alive. "Ophelia and Daphne not down yet, Flavia?" he asked peevishly, looking up from his latest issue of The British Philatelist, which lay open beside his meat and potatoes. "I haven't seen them in ages." It was true. I hadn't seen them, not since they had gagged and blindfolded me, then lugged me hog-tied up the attic stairs and locked me in the closet. Father glared at me over his spectacles for the statutory 4 seconds before he went back to mumbling over his sticky treasures. I shot him a broad smile, a smile wide enough to present him with a good view of the wire braces that caged my teeth. Although they gave me the look of a dirigible with the skin off, Father always liked being reminded that he was getting his money's worth. But this time, he was too preoccupied to notice.
So that's a wily little beginning, because it's her sisters that locked her in there.
Yes, it's her sisters.
Yeah.
So one of them is 17, and one of them is 13, and Flavia's 11.
She's the youngest one.
She's the youngest one, and she is incredibly clever and very lonely, but has this world of her own that is quite rich. She discovered a great-great uncle's wing in the house that was much disused, and it was a laboratory, a chemistry laboratory, and she really came into her own in that. She took it over as her own room and does experiments and sometimes mildly poisons her sisters.
Sounds like they might deserve it, so
they definitely
maybe it's
deserve
okay.
It.
Yeah.
She's such a great character. She's such a mixture of this, you know, bright and grown up in her thinking. She solves these mysteries, and she's really insightful about a lot of things, but she's so completely and childlessly blind about so many others. Mm. I just love this mixture of character. One of the things that about her that I relate to so much is she, her bicycle has a name, mm-hmm. and she rides it like it's a horse. And she will ride her bicycle and sing at the top of her lungs. And it's such a part of who I was as a child. It's just completely and totally relatable.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, too, how it seems like often books that have the child as the main character have this kind of the adults are a little bit out of touch. And even just in that brief section you read, you can get that impression, or I got that impression about the father already. Just like, it's not totally, it doesn't know what's going on, doesn't know his other daughters are locking his daughter in the attic. And
right. Well, he doesn't want to know, for one thing.
Sure.
But yes, I think that's absolutely true. I also think it underscores how that developmental stage of being so self-centered, you know, kids think of themselves. Even though they're insecure a lot of times, they also think of themselves as more in touch with what's happening than the people around them, whether or not it's true.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be accurate. Well, that is actually all the time we have today for the library show.
Wow, that went fast.
It does go fast, doesn't it? Thank you so much for coming in, Tracy.
Thank you.
And tune in next week for your next library show.